是的。
Who were your best friends, and where were their parents from?
My best friends were Carlos, Santiago, and Rita. And I think it was Maritza, I can't remember her name, but they were, we went to school together, and part of our experience was trying to go from an English learning environment to a Spanish speaking school environment. And we lived across, we lived down the block from each other, and then later on across the street when I moved down to 7th Street across from each other. They were, we were the same age, except for Carlos was the youngest, younger brother than Santiago, and Rita was their cousin. And we pretty much did things together, you know, in the Christmas time we used to have clubs that we used to skate. And you had competition among groups of skaters. We didn't consider it a game because it was a one type of event. And so you practiced during the year to perform different activities, I mean acrobatic activities, to show that you could earn the right to be in this group. And you earned stripes. And I think we kind of took that off the either the Army or off the Guardia Nacional. If you were there for a year and you were able to perform certain stunts, we will practice you in the year to get another stripe, you know. So I ended up being like a sergeant at one time. And Carlos was a sergeant, and although he was the youngest, those were good memories because we helped each other out. Even though we were competing to get an achievement, it wasn't to belittle each other or to tear each other down. It was to help each other, you know, little things that we could talk to each other about. The other good experience was playing house, you know. A lot of times we used to fight Carlos, Santiago, and I as to who would be the father, because it was three of us and Rita was the only girl, so she was always the mother. And or she would always be the nurse and we would be the doctor. But those experiences kind of shape, because you kind of use that exchange to imitate what your parents were doing, you know. Mm-hmm. So we use those type of experiences to say, oh, I'm going to cook some rice and peas, or no, I'm going to go to the market and get some, you know, some tripe and fix the tripe. And we'll pretend we're putting the ingredients in the pot to make the tripe, or we're trying to change the baby's diaper, you know. And that type of socialization really helped later on in life, because as you integrated what you went to school with, which is all the kids in school, in primary school, at that time, you had to learn how to sew a button. You had to learn how to saw wood, put in a screw, change a light bulb, shine your shoes, you know, the type of everyday activity that we take for granted now that you will hire somebody to do. Mm-hmm. We all learn, boys and girls, how to do those things. So if your uniform was missing a button, there was no excuse that you had to wait for your mother or your father to fix it, or you had to take it to the cleaners. There was no such thing. You had to do those things. And I think that helped give me not only a sense of balance, but also a sense of having a skill, you know, not being a master carpenter, but knowing how to saw, how to screw, how to change the light bulb, how to do minimal things that you could fix that made it important for us. So those were good experiences in my life. I think the other experience that was good for me is learning from my immediate family and extended family the value of their experiences. And as a child, you hear it, but you don't integrate it into what you're doing. But it was always said to us that you had to be better than anybody else. And one way you could do that is through education. And that was a mantra that was driven into us. And if you, that education could be a vocational education or it could be an academic type of education, but it had to be an education. Because you just couldn't be we didn't use the term bum at that time, but you just couldn't be a person who didn't have any skills or didn't have an education.
Mm-hmm. Your best friends, their parents were all?
Their parents were all from the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and I prefer to use the term Afro-Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about that later, about the West Indian thief, the misnomer that I call it. They were from, I think one parent was from Jamaica, and I don't remember who the other parent was from. I think they may have been Barbados, but we had a big mixture of people from the Caribbean, although predominantly from the, what they call the Big Island, you know, Jamaica, Barbados.
Have those friendships been maintained?
No, unfortunately. Once I came here in 64, I kept in touch with Carl, with Santiago and with Carlos, and we kind of lost touch after about 10 years. So one of the reasons I want to go back to Cologne is to kind of see, but it's going to be different because it's 43 years later, you know.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your parents and grandparents. Where were they from and how did they come to be in Panama?
Okay. On my father's side, my paternal side, I did not know my grandparents. They were still in Jamaica. My father came at a very young age, as a teenager, to Panama. He was from, I'll remember the name in Jamaica. But he came alone. And on my mother's side, my mother was born in Panama. My maternal grandparents were from Barbados, and they both migrated to Panama. My maternal grandfather died before I was born, but he was a bricklayer in the Panama Canal, and my maternal grandmother was a homemaker, both from Barbados. And my grandmother died when I was in college, about 18, yeah.
Okay.
So she migrated to the U.S. with my mother later.
Okay. You've already touched on this somewhat. What were their professions? You mentioned your grandfather was a bricklayer and your grandmother was a homemaker.
My mother was a seamstress.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was a administrative person. Office clerk in worked with the Panama Canal Commission,
mm-hmm.
On the Cologne side. I don't know what my paternal grandparents were in terms of their skills and profession in Jamaica.
Okay.
Spanish Town, that's the name of it. Spanish Town, Jamaica.
Okay. Who were your parents or grandparents' friends? Do you have any memories of visiting them or them visiting you?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, you know, in terms of grandparents and parents, people didn't visit; they just dropped in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't you didn't have to call, you didn't have telephone, but you didn't have to do anything formal.
Mm-hmm.
You just dropped in. That was the environment in which we lived, and you know, you shared what you have with them. I remember more of my mother's friends and some of my father's friends were always supportive of my going and getting education. That was another thing that always was a mantra, you know. How you doing in school? Make sure you go. Make sure you do your homework. You know, make sure you're taking care of that part of your life and having fun at the same time. The friends were a variety of friends, from people who work on the Canal Zone side, some people who we lived with formerly in Rainbow City, and then friends on Colón side. We had a few friends from Panama City, but mostly from Colón side. And, you know, a variety of both educators, pharmacists, other seamstresses, because my mother was much into the seamstress, and housewives. And then people who did odd jobs, whether it was a mechanic, a carpenter, or a bricklayer, or somebody worked in the theater or in the shops, were a variety of people that they made with. I always remember that mantra of education was universal across all the ages, both from my grandparents' friends and from my mother and my father's friends.
What sorts of things do you remember them doing or eating and drinking or talking about when they had company, when they had these people that drop in and visit?
Well, I know whenever we had let's say it was something prearranged that somebody was coming over, I had to go to the market, buy coconut, break the coconut, grate the coconut, squeeze the coconut milk so they could make it, put it in the rice. Mm-hmm. I probably hated the most the grating, because in those days the grater, you have to grate that coconut all the way down and try to not grate your finger. I think that was the worst thing that I hated, getting your fingers grated. But it also gave you a sense of participating in something that gave you a notion of how things operate. You know, I think today we can go to the freezer and pull out, or go to the store, pull out a frozen pack, bring it home, put it in the freezer, pull it out of the freezer, put it in the microwave, and put it in your plate, or leave it in the plate and eat it. This was more of a sense of you're engaged in something that was a whole communal sense, you know, because their children did the same thing when we went over to their houses, visited them. So everybody contributed, and I guess that's my sense, that I felt that I was contributing, although I didn't like that gratering, but I was contributing in something greater.
What was school like? How and who were your teachers?
Well, school was, let me start with kindergarten. When I started kindergarten in Rainbow City, because although my mother was at home, she felt that to begin the socialization and educational process, you need to be exposed that way with other kids. So I started kindergarten. Then shortly thereafter, after first grade, we moved to Colón, and I attended a Spanish-speaking school, I think it was Clemente, and had the uniform and everything. The school at that time was very rigid in terms of learning, in terms of discipline, and I remember my first grade teacher, Anna, always told my mother that if I focus more, I could do better academically. I wasn't doing bad, but I could do better academically. And boy, when I got home, the whole family knew about it before I even got from school. And I had her for like 2 years, so she knew who I was for two consecutive years, and that was, there was no slack for me to have. You know, you have a new teacher, so they get to know you. That experience was mixed in the sense that it was the first time I was going to Spanish school, what we call Spanish school, and it was the first time that I was going to an environment that was linguistically different from what I was accustomed to at home. I liked it for the sense of socialization, because a couple of my friends went there. And so we would walk, from 7th Street to school was like on 13th Street. So it was a nice little walk to school. And then on rainy days, we may get on the bus. But other than that, you had to walk it. I like the idea of, you know, my mother preparing lunch for me. That was a nice idea. And once my mother migrated to the United States and I switched schools to the Iglesia Metodista because they had a 6th grade starting there and it was bilingual, and we decided that it would be advantageous for me to begin the English learning academically, even though I was at home speaking English and listening to English activities. That school, I think, was an eye-opener for me in the sense of we were the first class to graduate out of there in the 6th grade, but it was the first class that really made a bilingual statement that we were competent in both languages. We had to show that. So that was an important and very significant thing that I remember. And it was in a new building too, so we were like really, really happy about this occasion. One of the other educational pieces that I found was very revealing to me and I still remember is learning to read English. For me was an experience because while you can talk a language and you don't know how to do the written part of it and reading part of it, they had an English speaking newspaper, English speaking language newspaper, I forgot the name of it, but I used to read the comics, the English comics, and you know, ask different people what this means and trying to read it and pronounce it. And I remember in the front of our building where we lived, there was a tailor, and he had like one section. It was a large, wide section. And so the tailor always had people coming in, you know, getting something made, and they will see me trying to struggle with reading the English language, and they will help me right away. And that's how I learned to read English, really, other than speaking it.
What was the last part of the question?
Second part.
Who were your teachers?
Oh.
Is it, well, how and who were your teachers? So your feelings about them and about their background. And
well, the other school that I went to before I went to 6th grade at Methodist school was Father Blake School, which is a well-known English institution in Cologne at that time. I think it was around 3rd Street, right across from the fire station, or we call it Casa del Bombero. And I went there for, I think, 1 year, and they had a rich tradition of really training you academically to be prepared in English. And I remember having a grammar teacher who did not go to college, but taught himself English through an exchange program. But he taught me the English language in terms of breaking it down. You know, when you talk about a verb, an adjective, an adjunct, I mean, everything was structurally sound. You got that background. Mm-hmm. And I always admire him for being that, not only dedicated to his students, but being dedicated to himself in terms of learning this and then be able to impart it. Because, you know, people can know something and not be able to impart it. And that was at Father Blake School. That part of my education was very sound, too. And it turned out that one of the counselors in that school, Ms. Brown, in 1973, ended up working for me in a place in Harlem. And Monica Brown. And when she connected, Dan Savage, I know that name. And when we kind of traced myself back to, Father Blake School. You don't remember me, I was your counselor. So those type of history that makes it important.
What other things do you remember about your time as a school child?
Well, both in Father Blake School and at Clemente, making sure your uniform was always clean and buttons weren't missing and stuff wasn't torn, you know, because as a kid you're playing around and stuff happened. I think that was, I was more afraid of that than not doing my homework because, you know, uniforms were expensive. I mean, you had to, it was a particular place you had to get your uniform and make it. So I was always afraid of, you know, something was torn, you know, you were broken up before you got home to show your parents that, you know, your pocket got torn because you were fooling around in the yard and somebody grabbed you and something happened. Mm-hmm. And aside from getting the beating and then, you know, trying to repair the item, that was more scary than not doing your homework at times. I think I also remember that the level at which our parents did homework with us varied. As I got more advanced, it was more left to me to do some of the more advanced work that my parents were not, at least my mother was not familiar with. But I could go down the street to somebody else who knew about, let's say it was math or division or something, that could help me do that. Because the transition from doing English, even something like division, you know, mm-hmm. in Spanish you do division a different way from English. And translating that was at times a mental piece because my first learning was in Spanish, so you did the division the Spanish way, but then you have to what we call the English way, mm-hmm. you know. So those type of things were something that you had to keep conscious about and work on in the educational process.
What was the cultural or racial background of your classmates and teachers?
Well, in Clemente, we were mostly Spanish-speaking, non-black. In Father Blake, it was all of African descent. And in Iglesia Metodista, was predominantly all African descent. I think there was one teacher that was what we call mestizo, mixed. But I think all of the teachers that influenced me, although they were predominantly of African descent, had a good impact on me, no matter what their background. I don't think at that young age there was a blatant show of, well, you can only do this. Mm-hmm. It was more a new learning experience. You know, you're talking about first and second grade where you were really more exposed to a lot of the basics, you know, mm-hmm. phonics and numbers. So it was kind of more open. I don't think the teachers were, at least in the Spanish school I'm talking about, were that close, you know, first, second, and third grade, because you really learn stuff for the first time in those settings. Mm-hmm.
What about your classmates? What were their...
Classmates, well, in the Spanish school, it was a mixture of classmates. In Father Blake, it was all people of Afro-Caribbean descent, mm-hmm. children of Afro-Caribbean descent. And in the Iglesia Metodista school was, again, all children of African descent.
Okay. What types of music did you grow up hearing? What were your favorite singers and favorite songs?
A mixture. I grew up in the house listening to Calypso, mm-hmm. Sparrow, Lord Kitchener, and those came out predominantly out of Trinidad and Jamaica and the Caribbean, and a couple of locals whose name I don't remember, but a couple of locals. And once I went outside of my household, you know, with your friends, we listened to both Calypso and Latin music. Cha-cha-cha. There wasn't any salsa at that time. It wasn't even called salsa at that time. Mostly Afro-Cuban music. And a few boleros, which is the slow song, love songs that people came out with. So that was my mixture. Later on, I think in the late 50s, we got into the R&B scene. And that was through the combination of some soldiers bringing music, and there was a station that would occasionally play one or two R&B. And then once by the 60s, we had 45 records. And interestingly enough, we had a mixture of both rock and roll, R&B, and for lack of a better term, white rock and roll, like Bobby Darin, you know, Harry Como imitation. And as television became more popular in the early 60s to mid 60s in Panama, you got exposed to the real apartheid system, which we didn't know at that time on television, which was, you know, Perry Como singing black people's songs in a different way. Well, we had no notion that was what was happening at that time. So people loved Perry Como and they loved Bobby Darin, you know, singing those songs. But one, we were exposed to a visual art piece for the first time. So those were the differences that we moved. But we always came back to our roots, which I considered the Calypso at that time.
What were your favorite songs?
I don't remember the exact wording, but I know I love Sparrow's songs and Kitchener's song because they were more political in the expression of people's sentiments that you couldn't in some ways politically express. They came through the songs, and the songs were written in such a way that it had a double entendre, you know. So those were the ones that I most liked. And then you have just the dance music type of songs, you know. And it varies from Kitchener to Sparrow to, I'm trying to remember the other gentleman, but it was a big battle between the like three main Calypsonians at the time. And we always were listening to, for carnival time in Trinidad and Tobago to find out who won the favorite for the year. And then that song got exported a lot and got played a lot if you were the winner. And then there were arguments about, you know, if you were a diehard Sparrow fan, you thought he was robbed, and if you were a diehard Kitchener fan and he didn't win, you thought he was robbed. And, you know, that was also a topic of conversation, as well as the political. Well, you know, Kitchener really meant this when he said that. And the other part that I remember in terms of some of the favorite stuff is I didn't fully understand it, but as I got older, maybe in the early 60s, I began to double entendre around sexual stuff. You know, it wasn't explicit. You know, but if you knew what they meant when he said, you know, I want an electrician to fix my socket. And when a woman sings that, it could mean her socket in the wall, it could mean another socket, you know. So those type of things, you to me, it was more artistic in the sense of trying to express something very artistically without being very blatant, you know. Because you could always say, well, no, I meant the socket in the wall.
Can I get you to sing part or recite part of your favorite lyrics? Anything you can remember you want to share?
Wow. I can't think of any right now. The dry mongoose. It's funny, I can't remember all the lyrics, but as soon as the band hits it,
mm-hmm.
it just flows with you.
Mm-hmm.
No, something will come to me, I'll come back.
Okay. What music do you listen to now? What are your favorite songs and what do you like about them?
Well, I listen to what I consider, I term it classical African-American music, which is some people call jazz. That's
mm-hmm.
my favorite right now. Well, it's one of my favorite right now. And also to West African djembe orchestration music. I'm getting into the folkloric music of Panama, and predominantly the Congo-influenced music of the folklore in Panama. But I listen to a variety of music. I try to be open to new music because I think that's the way things grow and flourish. I would like to see more integration as the world gets smaller, you know,
mm-hmm.
and people borrow from each other and enhance the culture in general, you know, and the understanding, because I think that's one of the benefits today in a very global society. But I like to listen to be open to all kinds. I mean, I'm just getting into Australian Aboriginal music,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in my head I begin to see connections, and I'm trying to sort those things out. How we can connect and learn from each other, and that's part of the process. Because I think
mm-hmm.
having a world in which we're getting a lot more connected means that you have to be better educated and better exposed to things, and that's an advantage that we can have given the internet system and the whole concept of networking throughout the world. But I like a lot of variety of things. I mean, I listen to what they call, quote, world music today. I love Afro-Cuban music, especially percussion type music, because I'm a drummer. So it enhances what I try to learn.
What are your favorite songs?
My favorite songs? Wow. A combination of, I love female vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always envision having a concert where I could call on somebody like Diane Reeves,
mm-hmm.
and then throw in somebody like Miriam Makeba, and then throw in somebody like Wilson, what's her name? Wilson. Can't remember her name. She sings kind of Delta blues with jazz. Cassandra Wilson.
Okay.
And Eva Elayon in from Peru to a sister from Ethiopia, you know, and have that type of transnational type of interaction, and just have people be exposed to that. But it's hard to say if I have one favorite, but I think we're probably more in the African genre of djembe music, because that's what I'm like trying to learn more of.
What is it about that music that you like so much?
The expression and the orchestration. You know, a lot of music that are African influenced, people tend to think it's it's not learned because it's not, it doesn't have a long history of written interpretation. And one of the benefits of doing African influenced music throughout the world, not just here, is that you have to feel it. And that's something you cannot write down. It's something that you have to learn if you don't feel it, and it's something that you have to be open to learn to feel it. And that is a primary goal or principle that you have to apply, whether you're learning Congo music from here, music from Venezuela, music from the Caribbean, music from Australia, music from Africa, whether it's east, north, or south. You have to feel it, you know. It's not all the Eurocentric way of everything has to be written to be valid. And I think that's what I like about it. It also affords you the opportunity to be expressive in how you feel about something, and recognize that expression is valid in the world. Just because you cannot write down every single note does not mean it is not valid in the world. And that's the main thing that I try to do and try to learn from. And that's why I like that type of expression. And oftentimes when we try to express something, the definition of it is taken away from us, or the attempt is to take away the definition from us by reinterpreting it because they write it down or someone else writes it down. It's supposed to us determining what it is and determining that is what our expression is in the world and claim it. You know.
Do you like to eat? And if so, what are your favorite foods?
Yes, I love to eat. I love to eat. I also love to create stuff.
Okay.
I try to, again, as part of my own expression, is to learn about a lot of cultures and bringing different things to what can work for you. The interesting thing, I lived in Nigeria for a year. When I was in college, I went to an exchange program, and I studied at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. And living there, and you know, you have to eat what the students eat because I was on the campus. And it was always very interesting to, when I first get a plate of Nigerian food, which is, you know, some of the staples that we have here, and people are like, wow, you can eat that, you know that? I said, this is what I grew up on. You know, plantains, yam, yuca, mm-hmm. You know, they may have mashed it as opposed to cooking it and, you know, in whole. Or they may have roasted the plantain as opposed to us frying it or boiling it. But it wasn't significantly different. So I try to use all those influences in making different things that I like. I became a diabetic in 2003, and some of my diet had to change. But it's not significantly, because I was pretty much kind of semi-vegetarian at that time, so it wasn't significant to alter my diet, you know, in terms of a lot of fried stuff, so I didn't do that. But trying to find alternative in bringing some of the food that I like, I don't eat pork. And I may eat meat like maybe once in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But once in a while I go and I have my curry goat or my oxtail. And I try to balance that in what I eat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always instructive to learn more about what I took for granted, you know, in the past, like what we call cho-cho or coyote.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good for different thing that you have, whether it's high blood pressure or stuff like that. So relearning some of the things that, even though I was taught how to cook it, I didn't make the connection between what it meant to you nutritionally and what you can use it for now. So it's been very beneficial to be able to tie back to, okay, yeah, when people used to drink Circe, I knew that was for you know, certain things, or when you had diarrhea and people give you guava, you know it was to bind you.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you didn't have a movement and people gave you the peel of oranges or mango or something else that made you, or aloe vera was for cuts and stuff like that. So it's kind of coming back circular, but in a way that you are making connections now to your own life and nutrition that you had in the past but didn't connect that as a young man and a kid.
Your favorite foods, you mentioned getting your curried goat and oxtail. You have some more favorites?
Oh, fried plantain. Mm-hmm. I still can't give a fried plantain, though I'm boiling it now more.
Mm-hmm.
Rice and peas. Definitely rice and peas. I kind of try to make a dish with, because I used to love green bananas.
Mm-hmm.
So now rather than just eating pounded green bananas or just, you know, boil, I now use it in a casserole layer. So I use tofu cheese, I use pineapple, and, you know, layer it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still have my green bananas, my tofu for my protein,
mm-hmm.
and my pineapple for my digestion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that type of combination now that I'm learning more to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to me, as I get older, it's more important because I see so many of us not, both in the United States and here, and so actually in most parts of the world where more processed food has taken over the more natural food, it's been amazing transformation. And I think that's a difference, you know. If I had something my grandmother would tell me, go down the street and go to the bush and pick certain things,
mm-hmm.
And I come back and we boil a tea, you know, to make that. Now you have to go buy it in a box.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it.
So do you cook your favorite, some version of all your favorite things? And if so, would you be willing to share recipes with us?
Yes. I have a salad that I call the Nubian salad.
Mm-hmm.
Nubian nutritious salad. It has about, well, it has a range of anywhere from 15 to 25 ingredients, and it's a whole meal,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, for instance, I put in watercress,
mm-hmm.
which I learned, I grew up on, chickpeas, which I grew up on, lettuce, spinach, parsley, which I grew up on, celery, which I grew up on, string beans, thyme, which I love. I use either onion or dry flakes onion, depending on what's available. Let me see, radish. I added, which is a new ingredient, I added bean sprout, which
mm-hmm.
I didn't know about at that time. Let me see. What else? Cucumber. One of the, after, I'll come to some more ingredients, but after I do that ingredient, you can enhance it by doing different things. You can add tuna to it, you know, but I do it separately, you know, I put the tuna aside,
mm-hmm.
or you can add grilled chicken to it, you can add salmon to it, I use different type of lettuce also. Cabbage, because I like the purple cabbage especially because it gives it a different coloring. You know, the coloring is nice. Carrots, of course. I usually have to make like a big pot of it because there's so many ingredients that you can't just make a small piece. And occasionally I may put the olives, but I have to wash it off because the bottled olives have a lot of salt in it. Mm-hmm. So I really like to wash it like two or three times to take the salt off of it. Zucchini, tomato. A couple of years ago, I didn't use tomato. I came into this by accident. My senior year in college, I had family come for my graduation, and you know, being a college kid, you don't have a lot of money, and I was like, wow, what can I do quickly? Because I don't know how to. You know, doing this, doing that, you can't run and cook and, you know, take them around. So I just decided to throw a salad together. Mm-hmm. And I just started throwing ingredients in the salad. And people loved it, and it kind of evolved from that, you know, into like a 20 ingredient salad. I do it around Kwanzaa time, and I do it around if I have a, you know, festivity at home or invite, you know, guests at home or the Conjunto Milenio, which I belong to. If we're having a fundraiser, I will donate the salad as a fundraiser to, you know, for food. But it's to me, it's a full meal, and I don't put any dressing on it. Mm-hmm. I will carry dressing and have people choose if they want to. But most people don't need the dressing. By the time you mix all those ingredients, you have all the juices flowing into each other, and it's a full meal. I put beans, I put garbanzo, red beans, or kidney beans in it too. Mm-hmm. Occasionally I may put some soft tofu, cut up some soft tofu and put that in there. And you know, it's very funny, but even with that, okay, I have to, if I know in advance who I'm serving, I will ask if anyone is allergic to any particular vegetable, because some people may be, you know, allergic to certain things, and I have to, when I start, I may set aside a small bowl for them without the added ingredients that they're allergic to. So it's scallion, celery, it's a long list. that's one of my favorite because you can do that any time of the year. Any time of the year. And usually when I finish it, I put it in Ziploc bags and give out the rest, and people put it in their freezer and then take it out when they need to and take it home.
What are your favorite sayings, and where did you first hear or learn of them?
My favorite saying, probably from Kwame Nkrumah, who was president of Ghana. What we need is people of action and action people who. No, what we need is people who think and people of action. No, wait, let me see. What we need is people. Action people who think, and thinking people who act. That's from his Conscientism book. And to me, it was always a principle that you wanted to reflect, that you could think as an African in this world, and that you could act. And the act is an acknowledgement of your self-determination in the world. But at the same time that you're doing that, your thinking and the action are connected. You know, you just don't think in some Eiffel Tower, or you just don't act on the street. The two are integrated for you to have your voice heard in the world, and that to me is very important.
Have you ever heard of Louise Bennett?
Yes, Jamaican Louise Bennett. Mm-hmm. Died a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Folklorist, yes, mm-hmm. Very. very pronounced in what I consider the African tradition in diaspora, in authenticating that, you know, speaking that voice to say, this is our experience. We speak it this way and we interpret it this way in the world. And that's valid for us. And people like Louise Bennett are overlooked in some ways in terms of the importance of authenticating our voices to the world, because she leaves a legacy that we can go back and see, hey, this, it just didn't start overnight, you know. She's interpreting stories from her ancestors that she's carrying and saying, they spoke it then, they weren't acknowledged then, but I'm here to bring it forward and acknowledge it to the world, you know. And it's valid because this is what we lived, this is how we lived. And that's an important thing that I keep emphasizing to younger people, that you need to do that. But part of that comes responsibility, because people like Louise Bennett took the responsibility to say, while I'm doing this, I also have to do it with a purpose. Mm-hmm. I'm responsible for carrying forth that. I'm not just going to sell it out, you know. She doesn't go to Sony Record and say, listen, give me a deal and I'll just sit in the studio and record these things and you give me the money and I'll go home. Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't do that. And that's part of the responsibility that comes with that. And to me, that comes out of a value system that is, that we're losing in the world as Africans throughout the world. Whether you're in Australia, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, or United States, or North America, that value system is being fast eroded. And our younger people need to get back into that value system, you know, to be reconnected to that value system more. I think some of it is there, but it's being detached slowly, you know, or eroded slowly, or fast, I should say, not slowly, fast.
What thoughts, if any, come to mind when you hear those names, Louise Bennett and the Mighty Sparrow? And have you ever seen them perform? And if so, what do you remember about those performances?
Yes, I've seen Louise Bennett in Brooklyn College in New York, when the Jamaican... I think it was Jamaican Dance Company and Louise Bennett came and did a theater piece. And I've seen Sparrow in New York. What I think about them is how rich a tradition we have throughout the world, that when I hear John Lee Hooker, I make a connection. Or when I hear Ali Fight in out of Mali and hear him sing a blues song, I see a connection. Or when I hear Jelly from West Africa, even though I don't understand the language, I know he's telling his story, and that makes a connection. So all of these individuals are connected in the sense that they're telling a story out of their own tradition that is expressing to the world something and authenticating to the world something. So I get a lot of respect for them. You know, I have a lot of respect for them in carrying out that tradition. They are, interestingly enough, they are, to me, not enough rappers doing that type of traditional stuff. Everyone wants to, while that's okay, everyone wants to do a new song to not necessarily promote or authenticate a voice, but to make money. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad, but if you do that only, you're in imbalance. You are at an imbalance, you know.
Which of their words or lyrics do you remember or know? Anything from?
Wow. Trying to remember Sparrow's word. Well, another Calsonia that I really admire is chalk dust out of Trinidad and Tobago. Very political in his lyrics and his rhythm. But Sparrow, I like some of, well, he did something in the 60s talking about black power. And I don't remember the exact wording of it because you don't hear it played that much. But I like that tune. And I like a lot of Chalk Dust music in the sense of he really promotes the betterment of the society, you know. And really talks about doing better for society, not just for the individual. So it's in that general, but I can't remember anything exactly out of his repertoire that I like, because I like most of his stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's that type of, when I hear those words, they always come back to, like I said, I don't remember it right now, but as soon as the record goes on, I start singing it.
Okay. What religion are you?
Good question. I don't consider myself any adherent to any one religious group or sect. I probably will come close to being an agnostic. And I think part of it is, you know, coming out of going to church and not understanding fully, even though you're enjoying the music and you're enjoying the camaraderie and the socialization and what that environment brings mm-hmm. to you. And I later didn't think it was a way in which I could live my life. But I respect those traditions and think that they have played a very valuable role in the development of black people throughout the world, not in, especially in the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. Both the Christian tradition and the more traditional African influence traditions throughout the diaspora. But I would say myself, I grew up Anglican. Well, I was baptized in Anglican, Christ Church by the Sea. I grew up Methodist because of my grandmother and my aunt went to Methodist school. And that's like the extent of the Christian part of my experience.
So what role does religion play in your life?
I will answer the question this way. Mm-hmm. The traditional religion, meaning, you know, Christian, Judeo-Christian religion, plays a role insofar as some of the values that it exposes that I think are important to us as African people. Mm-hmm. But I also use some of the ancient African religious values to also influence my life. So it's not just a organized religion piece that I use, but I use the values that they are built around. Mm-hmm. And those are the important tenets, you know, to honor people, to respect people, to love each other, to obey, you know. Those are values that are throughout just about all religions that I find useful for me to live my life. So I live a more secular life, but I inculcate those values from that religious tradition because that's the basis of our existence. And that's the people.
I'm going to ask this next question, which doesn't seem necessarily in line with your answer that you just given, but I want you to express whatever it inspires in you.
All right.
Would you mind describing your favorite part of the worship service? So you could take this opportunity to describe your own spirituality if you like.
Well, I like the part where you connect, you know, when people feel connected the spirit hits you and you connect. It was interesting that my aunt was my my mother's sister, because I have an aunt on my father's side. But my mother's sister's aunt, my mother's sister, was although she grew up Methodist, she practiced kind of a mixture of Christianity with more, I would call them more traditional African belief systems. Not without putting any negative connotation.
Mm-hmm.
They were very spiritual, so they would get possessed. And I remember a couple of times being in her room in a rocking chair, and I would take out the Methodist hymn book and start singing and start feeling things in her room. And I remember once she came in and I had to put cool compress on my head, and I was in the spirit, and I was feeling good. And I never had that experience again, but it still stays with me to today. And so I enjoy the connectedness, that you are joyous about something and you connect with the spirit, in the sense of it isn't something you can write down. I'm feeling, my left arm feel this way, or my right eye is twitching. It's not that kind of cut and dry. And attending some of her ceremonies, I wish I had gotten to be more knowledgeable about it. But I, in speaking to my roommate in college who was from Trinidad, he also told me about that tradition, and I said, oh, and there's connections, between how we express ourselves with the mixture of the traditional Christian values with African values, and African traditions. And then my aunt and my brothers on my father's side, who is from Cuba, is practice Santeria, and out of the Yoruba culture. And I remember when I was in Nigeria, I came back and I brought her this book on the Yoruba belief system. Boy, she was just she was in heaven, because it was a book that was just translated into English. That had been in the Yoruba language for 10 years, and so I like the worship part of the service. Even going to a traditional church, and that's one of the things I didn't like about the Methodist church. They were too dry in terms of imitating the Anglican part of them. The songs were so dry. In my view, dry, dragged out. Everything was dragged out, Holy, holy, holy. As opposed to holy, 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 God bless. That type of tradition. In fact, one of the things that we try to do in New York with the drums is to bring that into some churches. And it's been mixed. Some people think that's the devil. You bring a drum into a holy sanctuary. And others say, no, it's an expression of what we're connecting to now. And also it brings young people into it. And that's the tradition that I like. I like that part of the service. In fact, I will go to an Easter service a lot quicker than I will go to a regular service, because Easter is more celebratory. It's more involved. But I like that part of a service, of a spiritual sense of connecting, and being free, because the expression that you're giving to the world is that. For that moment in time, you're connecting to something, and again, you can't write everything down about this, but it's an expression that you're connecting, and you have to experience it to know it.
Did you play sports as a child? And if so, what sports?
I played, in Panama we didn't do much basketball, because at that time basketball wasn't that popular until like the mid-60s. There were some basketball players, but not significant. So baseball was the main sport.
Mm-hmm.
Either baseball, volleyball, or boxing. What we call football, what they call soccer. So I played a lot of volleyball, played a lot of baseball, loved baseball, was going to be, a New York Yankee. And at one time I was going to go into boxing, but before my mother left, she told me if I did that, she would disown me. So that ended my boxing career. And at that time, Ismael Laguna, who was a top contender, from Panama, lived right down the block from us, so he would have us come out with the big boxing glove, so that we won't hurt each other, like 12 ounces glove, and show us different, different tricks and stuff, and we were like crazy about it. So all of us wanted to be boxers at that point, and become the next Ismael Laguna, because then he moved into, once he became champion, he moved into a big house, and so you saw the elevation, but that was the, baseball was the main thing. I think I did a touch of basketball. Didn't hit me as much as it. Because I don't think there were enough setting basketball courts and stuff like that as opposed to that. And one time somebody bought some football, American football, garments or something. I said, put all this stuff on in the heat and you're sweating. It just didn't, after you play, when you're like dehydrated and stuff, So that didn't hit me too easy. But the baseball was the main thing, and volleyball.
Do you still watch or play these sports?
I don't get to play that much baseball now, but I will go out every once in a while to the park and play some softball. I played a couple of volleyball games with people from my job. We were trying to do a league, and
mm-hmm.
it didn't quite work out, but that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get to do that much, the volleyball that much.
Did you have any contact with the United States culture as a youth, and what do you remember about that?
Well, yeah, plenty. like I said, my father worked in Canal Zone, mm-hmm. but after we moved to Cologne, we still had connection with them. We had an English speaking newspaper that brought a lot of American stories. Not everything, but gave us a little semblance of what America was like. Although I think it wasn't a full picture, but you got little pieces of it. I think probably in the 60s when television came is when we got
mm-hmm.
more exposure in a predetermined way. And the reason I say predetermined was that box predetermines what you see.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see the full picture of America. We didn't know that the racial discrimination, apartheid system really existed
mm-hmm.
in its heyday in the mm-hmm. late 50s and the early 60s, or that there was this uproar, or that there were images that we saw on television and imagined that was the image of the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
So when you saw the Pat Boone Hour or the Perry Como Hour, and you saw maybe Sammy Davis, you were like, wow. He was like an aberration. And I couldn't quite place him, so you say, okay, he's just one exception, without viewing the full context of the American society. Probably the other thing that I strictly remember is what we call American pear,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to avocado. The avocado was native to us, but the American, so we call them both pears, but to say, when you say American peer, everybody knew you mean a peer that came from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And probably, I forgot the name of the soft drink that they used to advertise all the time on TV from the United States. I think it was Royal Crown Cola, if I'm not
mistaken.
RC, yeah. Because we had Orange Crush in Panama. But it's just those type of exposure that we got, again, you know, very, very premature or segmented.
Tell me about your view of your West Indian ancestry.
Okay. My view is that first I've come to the not accept the term West Indian because I look at its history. You know, Christopher Columbus got lost, was going to the East Indies, got lost, and when he found land, said it was, oh, it's not the East. So it must be the West, and hence the West Indian. So, not giving any power to Christopher Columbus, I'm taking that away. I'm not accepting being a West Indian. I'm of African descent, or if you want to say African Caribbean descent, that's more appropriate. Or black from the Caribbean. One pause. Oh. And I wanted to know that my history is connected to Africa. That the way I look at the experience, the African experience in the Americas is what I prefer to use, is that that connection has to be made so that we are whole. You know, we just didn't land, fell out the sky and landed in Jamaica or Barbados or Trinidad or Antigua or Panama. That connection has to be made. And that connection is important for me to pass on to my child. But it's also for me to articulate to the world that we are of African descent and we have a connection, even though we have particular things in the diaspora that are unique to us. But that's our validity in the world. I always remember when I was in college trying to get my grandmother to accept the term African. Boy, never mind black. And what was ironic is that my maternal grandfather was a Garveyite, and his wife was totally against it. You know. So it was always a conflict, you know. And I remember trying to my freshman year coming back from school. You know, I came back with the black beret and the sunglasses and the camouflage jacket, and I made sure I took a picture next to her because I wanted to show. I didn't fool her, but I just wanted to let her know I'm still your grandson, you know, with a different perspective. And I always liked that picture to see, you know, my grandmother, because she had long hair and fair skin, and me in this black beret with the panther button and the shades, you know. But it's a sense that we still don't have a full connection and an integration of our African self. I think we're getting there. It's you know, like the Dia de la Negra is a positive step, and that's one of the reasons I decided to come back after 43 years, was to see for myself, to experience it, and to connect with people that are here about where they are. I sense that we are all proud of our ancestors, but that ancestry kind of stops in the Caribbean. Some people may give verbal acknowledgement to Africa, but they don't have an integral sense of what it means to be an African in the diaspora. And all its complexity, I'm not saying it's simple, all its complexity. But I think as that develops, my main concern is that I don't see enough of our young people being involved to I think it's happening, but not enough to bring them into that concept. And while I think there are some good efforts, and I applaud people who are doing those efforts because that's a start, that's something that people are doing in an organized fashion that has merits and should be supported, it still needs to be pushed. You know, because as people of African descent in the diaspora as well as other parts of the world, we begin to see our interconnectedness, and that speaks to how we see the world and how the world then begins to see us. And the Caribbean piece is but one of the connections. It's an important one, but it's one of the connections. I just find it ironic that, you know, in the world, whether you're in the United States or here, you have more black people who are financially better off than ever before, but you also have the masses of black people who are worse off. And that's a disconcerting piece, both here in the Caribbean, in the Americas, and in Africa. You know, all over. So it's not a phenomenon to here or United States or Caribbean. All of us have that phenomenon.
The 90-minute tapes.
Oh, yes.
So
I thought when you said
Well, I was telling her that we had we actually still have about 10 minutes. This is a 94-minute tape.
Okay.
Well, we can stretch 94 minutes
out. Well, we can answer these two less than the West Indian section. Let's answer these two less than the West Indian section.
And then,
so I have to be less than 10 minutes, right?
You're doing fine, thank you.
Sure, don't want to change? Okay.
What's the first word that comes to mind when someone says West Indian?
Oh, really, that's what comes to mind. For me, in the past it was like, yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say, oh, is because I know what they mean or what they're trying to mean, so I try to address it.
Mm-hmm.
And my way of addressing it is that I will start off by saying I am of African descent from the Caribbean, or my parents are of African descent from the Caribbean, so that it begins to give a different spin right away. And yes, I acknowledge that's an important part of my experience, and I want to pass it on to my daughter, but I am not going to let someone else name me, you know, and I go into that explanation. But generally, I know what they mean. Sometimes, depending on the venue, I may show the expression. Another time, it's an internal expression, and then I, you know, appropriately answer it. But it's something that is it's hard to combat. And I was talking to someone today about, you know, how the progress of naming has gone. And I use the experience in the United States that, you know, we landed as Africans, we then became Negroes, colored, then black, then African-American, then African, you know. So the progress of naming oneself is very important, but I want people to understand that it is a process, it is not the end result. You know? So we may start off with West Indian and you may start off with something else. But I think it's fundamental for people to remember how we got that name. That name was given to us. We did not name ourselves that. We took that name from other people. That's the important piece that I want people to understand.
What qualities, cultural behaviors, or other things do you associate with West Indianness?
Okay. Well, one of the strong traditions is that you believe in law, you believe in God, you believe in family, you believe in education as a means of progress, and you believe in community to the extent that you exchange, you give back, you share. And that sharing could be both a financial as well as a resource or information. So it doesn't have to be necessarily material sharing, but it could be a resource sharing of information and ideas that could happen. And that sharing is part of the support system that I think was one of our strong marks in our value system.
Do you believe that people in Panama view or treat you differently based on your race or being of, we say it says West Indian, or being of African descent from the Caribbean?
Well, I get treated differently in different ways. Mm-hmm. I get treated differently for being, once I'm recognized as a Yankee. I get treated differently as a black male in this society. Whether it was funny, two nights ago, we were trying to go from China's to come down to a ledger, and I couldn't get a taxi. You know, so they drive right up, as soon as they see me, sped off. At night, it's a nighttime thing. And I understand the context in which the taxi drivers are operating because they're probably robbed by people who look like me. But, you know, it's the same thing in New York. Sometimes I can't get a cab. I'm also treated differently, I think, in the context of if I speak English and Spanish, can't kind of quite figure out, you know, where I belong in certain environments. And yeah, definitely the race plays a part. I experienced that last night in the Hotel Panama, you know, trying to cast a traveler's check. And, you know, the first impression was like, what are you doing with traveler's check type of attitude? Didn't say it, but the attitude. And then, you know, I said, no, I broke into English because I purposely wanted them to know, one, that I didn't steal these checks as a local here. You know, I have possession of these checks legally. So all of those reasons, being a black male, being a what they would consider a non-Panamanian without knowing, and also being a black person.
Do you believe that people in the U.S., or any country you've lived in, mm-hmm. I know you spent it here in Nigeria, for example, mm-hmm. view or treat you differently based on your race, your being of Afro-Caribbean descent,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's from replacing with Indian, or your being Panamanian?
No. I was probably treated differently because I was considered, quote, American, unquote.
Mm-hmm. The people in the U.S., do you think they...
Oh, the people in the U.S.? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I thought you meant people in other countries that I've lived. Yes, that happens, sure. Sure that happens. And it depends on... Sometimes it's positive because once they pick up that you share a similarity, they may embrace you more or give you more latitude. Or also, once they see a dissimilarity, they may push you back further or act differently towards you. So it's worked in both ways. I try to be straightforward with people, and, you know, you take it how you see it. In outside of the United States, it's more based upon you being a quote American until you break down that stereotype, you know, until you address it. I remember once in Nigeria in 72, at the time they had students were rioting, were protesting school fees and against the government, so they closed down the universities. And there were like eight of us, and so she was like a mother to all of us. She told us, you know, we should come to one location and kind of stayed there because the National Guard the army was on the campus, and they just loved to beat students, you know. So I was walking toward there, and I got surrounded like about 10 National Guardsmen with their batons. And they saw I was a single student standing there. They were ready to pounce on me. And I broke into my straight Brooklyn accent. Yo, what's happening, man? What you all trying to do? And they like, oh, he's not one of these local students, you know. Mm-hmm. He's back off. And that's how they backed off. So I've always considered myself very fortunate to be able to move between those cultures, you know, and use them appropriately. Use them appropriately. You know, when I'm in the taxi now, they start saying something. Sometimes they can detect my accent in certain things that I would say, but, you know, I try to minimize it and let them know, you know, like I know where I'm going or I know certain things, and it works. So that's something that I wish my daughter had, because it to me is so enriching, you know, as I travel. It's really enriching. And it's almost like I see it here too, where generations have, like second or third generations have lost some of that value in being bicultural, being bilingual even, you know, where you can move between the cultures easily. And it's a skill as well as a gift that people should value and not think it's, you know, it's valueless. It's valuable.
Perfect.
Okay. A minute to clear?
Yeah, like 2 minutes.
Oh.
What do the people you encounter there in the U.S. seem to think or know about Panamanians or Panamanians from Afro-Caribbean descent?
Well, in Brooklyn, it's very easy because that's the mainstay of a Panamanian community, a very strong Panamanian community, and a very strong African Panamanian community. Outside of New York, it varies. I think in parts of New York, because there's another Latino presence, and you start to speak Spanish, they may associate you with being Dominican, especially darker Panamanians. So I've had that experience of, you know, being mistaken for Dominican until they kind of listen to you and know that that's not a Dominican accent that you have, and then you talk about being from Panama. The non-Latino population have, I think, not too bad an expression if you speak in Spanish, but if you're more on the English side, they may think of you as an African American, and that speaks to a whole other type of relationship and expression and experience that you go through. So, for instance, like I talked about the cab situation in New York, you know, an African Panamanian standing in the waiting for a cab, male especially, will have the same experience as an African American born in the United States. You can't get your cab. You get into the cab, though, if you start speaking Spanish, you may think, oh, well, maybe you're not from here. Maybe you're different from those others.
Mm-hmm.
And that may or may not help you depending on how you use it. So I think it is a mix of who you interact with and where you're interacting. Within the five boroughs, I think it's a little easier for within the Latino community. And outside of New York, it's a quite different experience.
How do you think living abroad has affected your views of Panamanianness?
Hmm. Well, I think one of the benefits of living abroad is that it has broadened my perspective in a much more Pan-African sense, in a much more global sense, that you are more exposed to a variety of differences globally, and therefore that can help you see the connectedness. Not automatically, doesn't happen automatically because you have to educate yourself in some ways. But the chances, the probability of getting that that same type of exposure in Panama is less than I think abroad, especially in the United States. Like I said, not that it cannot happen here, but I think the probability is greater outside of Panama. I think it's also an issue of how willing you are to expose yourself to those situations. If you are mainly just doing the 9-to-5 or the 8-to-4 type job activity here, as well in the United States, you're not going to get that chance. But if you go to a meeting or know someone who went to a meeting and read something and get a different exposure, it opens up your world. Definitely the fact of living abroad in other countries other than the United States or Panama also helps, because you begin to see the perspective of that country to some extent, or the people of that country, and how they interpret their world as well as how they interpret the rest of the world. And that's always fascinating for me. You know, people even when I was in Nigeria were talking about how rich everybody was in New York, you know, without understanding the context of what it means to be rich in New York versus what it means to be rich in Nigeria. The fact that they are homeless people in New York would not enter into their thought pattern because they get a prescribed message from television, which is generally not showing that issue unless, you know, there's some catastrophe with some person on the street. And I think similarly, being here in Panama, you will get certain preconceived news information and resource information. One of the benefits, I think, though, is that the internet has offered is that people can gain more access to that. And I'm really pleased that at least in Panama, you can, you know, people don't have computers in their home, but they can access computers through, you know, through these stores that are providing the service. So that's an avenue that can be used moving forward.
How do you think living abroad has affected Panamanians and Panama's views of you?
Repeat that.
How do you think living abroad has affected Panamanians in Panama, their views of you? Is that something you've been able to observe or digest in these few days that you've been back in Panama?
No, I haven't gotten much of that. I think they're more curious as to why I stayed away that long, first of all, and why I'm coming back until I explain what happened. I mean, I only have one brother here, so all my family had been in the United States. And my returning to Panama was to one, to begin to see for myself what the status or what the consciousness was in terms of celebrating the Enya Negra, which is to kind of be on the ground level seeing that and how people interpret that, how people address that, and how people use that to move forward. I don't think most people have any, at least so far in Panama City, have had any, I've seen any difference in terms of how they interpret me having coming back. I think most of the people that I've talked to have been very happy that first they were kind of sad that I stayed away that long, but then they were happy that I decided to be here, you know, after these years. And most of the time, their main expression is for my well-being, you know, mm-hmm. just to try to be careful, you know, enjoy the city, enjoy when you're here, but try to be careful. Mm-hmm. And that was saddening in some way, but I was grateful on the other hand that, you know, they were concerned about me, but saddened that the level of which our society has, in Panama, has deteriorated is that personal safety is now a major, major factor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a saddened part of my journey here, return. And it's countered by the symbolism of all these large towers going up, you know. And I find the irony there in that the larger the towers and the more towers, the greater the disparity in both people's well-being and people's connectedness to saying we can make a difference. Everybody just trying to live, eke out their life rather than make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is the sad part of my return here.
Mm-hmm. How has living abroad affected your relationships with U.S. African Americans?
I was living abroad. Living abroad, you mean?
I guess whatever time you spend outside of the U.S., how does that impact your ability to, but how does it impact your relationships with U.S. born African Americans? Is your experiences outside the U.S., how does that influence how they interact with you?
Overall, I think it's been a positive one,
mm-hmm.
in that I can bring back experiences.
Mm-hmm.
to Africans in the U.S. to begin to see our connectedness,
mm-hmm.
and begin to see our differences as well. You know, not just the, you know, not that everybody's the same, but that there are connectedness and that there are similarities and there are dissimilarities. And to explain those things in the context of where we need to go forward,
mm-hmm.
it's I think instructive in that my wife was born in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and so was my daughter. And while I look at that, I look at my father. You know, my father was born in Jamaica, but his wife was born in Panama, and his sons and daughters were born in Panama. You know, so that I look at that pattern of migration to say, wow, you know. Look at that. There's a similarity there insofar as having born in one place, migrated to another, and developed a family. You know, and that's a rich. To me, I try to use that as a richness to show my daughter that she has something valuable there. You know, it's valuable. It's not just because there are differences in location or geographics that makes it worse. It makes it better for her.
How has not knowing, or in your case, knowing English, affected you, whether positively or negatively?
Oh, it's been a blessing. It affected me positively. Although I think in my initial venture in the United States, my first year, I should say, in the United States, it was somewhat of an adjustment in expressions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And still thinking bilingually and not thinking just in English. Like for instance, you go to the store and you see the word fair.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading it as sally, meaning go out. You know. Why does that sign say to the front go out? You know, and mm-hmm. then you have to put on your English, oh, sale. They're having a sale in the store. Not so you can go out to the store. And I find that the way in which you approach certain things makes a difference insofar as what experiences you can bring. You can bring a positive experience to something new that you're trying to integrate. You know, I remember when I was starting junior high school, my first year, not knowing, I knew a little bit of U.S. history, but not knowing, you know, a lot of U.S. history by junior high school. One of my history teacher, I always remember this guy, Mr. Davis, really saw that while I was struggling, I had a yearning to learn about it, you know. And he kind of said, if you want to stay after school, I will go over stuff with you in history. And that just built my knowledge base, but also built my self-confidence, because then I could translate that into science and language arts, as they called it at that time, to know how to recognize my limitation, but know that I can achieve something, you know. And that person I always remember, you know, was a very influential part in giving me that extra nudge that I needed at a time when you were brand new to a situation. So academically, it helped me. Initially, they wanted to hold you back 1 year because we start, I think, at seven, when you're 7 years old here, versus six, I think, when you start there. So they wanted to hold me back a year, and my mother kind of insisted, no, give him a few months and see what he can do. And that Mr. Davis really picked me up to help me through the language arts and the science and the math stuff to carry me over. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get left back as a consequence. So. Mm-hmm. I always remember that, and because he came out of a background of a Peace Corps, mm-hmm. so he had lived, I forgot what areas, but he kind of, you know, was sensitive to people who were coming into new environments and, mm-hmm. and knew that, and it was interesting because at the end of the year, the end of the following, my 8th grade, which you graduate, I graduated with honors in history. Mm-hmm. And he was very proud of that because he was a history teacher, of course, mm-hmm. and that became like my favorite subject, actually. And the consequence, he gave me a couple of booklets. And one of the booklets I already remember was the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. And he said, when you read this and you go back to Panama, you will see the difference. I want you to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Of course, no, I went back to Panama, but... No, I always remember that.
Are you married?
Yes.
How did you meet your wife?
I hired her. I don't mean hired her in that sense. I was the education vocation director in a residential treatment center in Harlem, and we had an educational component at the classroom. So she was. I hired her as a teacher for the educational component. We were best friends for over a year, and I actually used to tell her all about, you know, the woman I was dating and stuff, get advice from a, you know, from a female perspective, and we just became best friends. And you know, we would go out, you know, like the three of us went out. The guidance counselor on her, and one thing that led to the other, and we were involved, and you know, we got married 2 years later in Jamaica, I might say, because one of the things that I always wanted to do, I never wanted the U.S. to sanction my marriage, you know, for some reason, and I think probably because of how my father got treated with the Panama Canal, and I never wanted that to be something that I want the government of the United States to approve my marriage. Mm-hmm. You know? They may recognize it, but not approve it. Mm-hmm. So I was told, we have to get married outside the United States. And I felt going back to the land of my father was the most appropriate thing. So we got married in Montego Bay in Jamaica. Okay.
How would you characterize the cultural background of your spouse? And did her family have any issues with her choosing you as a partner?
well, African American from the South, but she grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. And actually, the The hardest part was her, she was the youngest of two, so she was the baby of the two, her brother and her. Was probably her mother, you know, who was this guy you are now serious with. Once I think she got to know me, first there was reluctance, not because I was of Panamanian descent, but just a guy dating her daughter, you know, is he good enough type of thing. But once she got to know me, she calls me her son. I mean, we've been, I call her my mother now, you know, that's 25 years later. In fact, sometimes she said, you're nicer to me than my own son. I said, well, but I am your son. She said, you know what I mean. And of course, she thanks me for giving her a beautiful daughter, a granddaughter, you know, that's her way. But the other part, I think, was when I had my name changed. Which can I go into this now? You want to
sure.
wait? I was actually born Dan Anselmo Savage in Cologne, son of Dan Savage and Miriam Moore Savage. In 1971, I adapted an African name after doing a lot of research, because I felt it was closer to my value system at the time and reflected more my perspective of being more of an African. Than the English version of the name. So I had the name since 1971. And then in 1986, once my wife got pregnant, we decided that we would not give her the name Savage, the surname Savage. We were giving her the surname Nubian. And to make it more easy for her, from our daughter or our son at the time, you know, to not be able to, not have to explain, well, why is your father named this and your name that, I decided to change the name legally to Nilaija Amhos Bayano Umwata Nubian. And so we gave her the surname Nubian. I did the paperwork myself, saved some money, and changed the name legally. So when she was born, she had the surname Nubian. Two interesting points happened. My wife's mother, while she would call me Mwata all along, because that's the name she was introduced for, when I did it legally, I could see there was some resistance there. It's like, this is like the final, you know, when you do something legally, it's like final, you know. Just like when you get married, it was like, okay, now he's serious about my daughter, so why does he do then go and change his name? So that was it. The harder part was my own mother at that time. She passed about 8 years ago. But at the time, when all these years people would call the house, ask for Mwata, ask for Benubian, no problem, you know. She knew it was just a name that I had because I was in college and involved with the politics and stuff like that. But I didn't change it legally, so there was still a connection. But once I did it legally, she stopped talking to me. To just me. We lived like across the street from each other. And she would come over, she would see her granddaughter, she would talk to my wife, she would call. If I answered the phone, let me talk to Sandy, my wife. Babysit for us, I was persona non grata for about 3 months. And then her own peers started telling her, why are you treating your own son like this when he's not in jail, he's not beating his wife, he's responsible in the family, you knew the name, it's not like he sprung this on you. And it's not like he's not connecting your granddaughter to you as though he severed all ties to you by the name change. And they pressured her to come around and talk to him. And that's how that changed. It wasn't because of anything I did. Those were very, it was very tense at that time, you know, for me personally to be. You know, because you talk to somebody and somebody will kind of talk to somebody else to talk to you or give you the eye. You know, one of the things with our tradition too, they give you the eye look, and that look means like, don't talk to me. I am not talking to you without saying that word. Mm-hmm. Or you say something to her and you know what that means. Like, I'm not paying you any attention. Okay, don't even bother me. So all those things changed when her peers talked to her and had her change the attitude. My adapting the name again was to reflect that. You know, I wanted to change the view of my connectedness to my African culture, but part of my African culture is my family, and I can't disconnect from them, you know. But it's another branch of the tree. That's how I told her, I expressed it. I'm now another branch of the same tree. My daughter is going to know about her grandparents, going to know about her great-grandparents. You know, she's not going to be disconnected from you. She's not disconnected from you. So it's not like I'm saying, I'm changing my name and I'm moving away and that's it. That worked out eventually okay, but it was a hard 3 months to go through with that expression.
Did your wife change her name?
No, she didn't. And we gave, we've also decided to give our daughter an African name. So she's the odd person out, so to speak.
So you have one daughter.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about your daughter and her life and... Is she working now, or is she still at school?
She's still in college. My daughter's name is Ayana, and we gave her, you know, a name that, again, we try to reflect. Although I thought all along that I was having a boy, so we had all boys' names. It was like the last thing which we had to name her in the hospital was when we decided on this name. And the other part that we had to struggle with is once we picked a name, I wanted an African name. I didn't want an Arabic name. And I was clear about that too, you know, in terms of naming her as an African, not as an Arabic name. So we went back and forth with that. But we named her, you know, an African name. And it was... I would say one of my just seeing my daughter being born was one of my joyous day or hour, minute in life, just to see a life come forward and it's yours, you know, and you were responsible for it. And my daughter was born in Manhattan, at NYU Hospital. May 15th, I'm May 9th and she's May 15th, so Taurus kind of ruled the household. And it makes us clash also, because we're both Taurus type influence people. But we try to give her a value system that gives her a foundation that makes her responsible for her actions and understand that, maybe not right away, but eventually she will understand that there are consequences to all of our actions, whether it's us or her, that she has to, that each person has to address. She was a, she wasn't premature, but she was born the same weight as her mother, and neither of them were premature. That was very interesting. I always wanted to, my wife got pregnant, my grand plan was to have 12 kids and to eventually move out of the United States to either the Caribbean or to Africa. 25 years later, one child, we still live in the United States. So... I'm very proud of my daughter. I think the hardest part for both my wife and I have been the teenage years, you know, because it's a transformation between her being the child that we tell things to do to the child and now interprets what she wants to do and begin to assert her own definition and self. And that's been the strongest, the hardest adjustment period that we're going through now. So I'm hoping her 20s will be a lot easier for her to move into that adjustment period. I call her an ex-dancer, though she doesn't like the term. She still likes to dance. She was considering majoring in dance, but is right now in between deciding whether to do dance therapy or to do psychology with a dance therapy minor. And I said, you know, whichever, but as long as you're doing something educationally, or if not, you're trying to make up your mind, then you have to work, and that's an important part to contribute for her. Because I think in trying to make your make her life better as parents, we don't want her to think that everything can be given to you. Some things you have to earn. Mm-hmm. And so part of the value system is to learn to earn. I keep telling her, you know, we've always practiced the Kwanzaa, the Nguzu Sawa system. And part of one of the value system is to have self-determination. And part of that self-determination is to try to find your way sometimes. You know, and it's not easy for a young person these days. But you know, that's her struggle, and that's what we're there to try to support. But we want it to be clear to her that she has to do something positive and make her own self-determination.
Does she consider herself Panamanian or of African descent from the Caribbean or both or something else? Or how does she define her?
I think it's evolving for her.
Mm-hmm.
At first she was, I think younger age she was probably more African American, although she always did, you know, when you're in primary school you have to tell, you know, like a family tree history or you do something like that or something special about your parents or somebody, a relative or somebody. So she always did stuff in Panama. She was always interested in that. I think she probably in high school switched, when I heard it I was like, what? Called herself Hispanic. and I remember having a couple of discussions, because it wasn't just one discussion, as to what does it mean to be Hispanic?
Mm-hmm.
And, actually, and she had to come to the realization when she faced it that she is more than, quote, Hispanic at that time in high school, meaning that she began to realize that while she has Latino influences, she also has Caribbean influences, she has African American influences.
Mm-hmm.
So she had to, in her own head, reevaluate not just my part, you know, because that's where I think she was. I think she kind of took the African American thing for granted, being born there and so forth. But learning more about this side was, I think, the opening for her, so it kind of overwhelmed the African American side.
Mm-hmm.
At least the African American from the U.S. side. So her value was, you know, what am I? And I said, well, what do you think you are? Because I said, you're not Hispanic, because that's from Hispaniola or the Iberian Peninsula. And, you know, explain to her what that meant in terms of her her direct connection to her parents. I said, I'm not from the Iberian Peninsula, and neither is your mother. So then she switched to Latina. I said, okay, and what does that mean, though? Well, she tried to explain that it meant more of, she has a Panamanian connection, she has a Jamaican connection, she has a Cuban connection. I said, well, yeah, what else? And, yeah, I guess I'm Latina African American. I think that's her latest, you know, Latina African American, because she sees more of the integration now, or more the recognition of something she kind of took for granted on the African American side.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, can't you just be an African in the diaspora? And she looked at me. I said that to her about 2 years ago. she looked at me, and she came back about a couple months later, said, you know, I looked up this stuff about the African diaspora, and kind of have to find out more about it, you know. So at least I think she was on the right path. But I think she sees herself more whole now in terms of not taking the African American part for granted, you know, because she recognizes the Southern tradition, things that she has to do, and recognizing the Panamanian connection and the Caribbean connection, you know. So it's like she loves sugar cane and fried plantain, because we're semi-vegetarian, so, you know, she always asks me, what is oxtail taste like, or what does curry goat taste like? I have to try to describe it for her because she has no sense of what it would be like to eat meat, you know. But she will have a roti, she will have a chicken patty, you know, and a poco bread, and those type of things, you know, rice and peas. I mean, she knows more about that connection, and she'll do hop and john, and she'll do cornmeal, and she loved to make cornmeal porridge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in school, it's very cheap, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll make grits at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, and I try to tell her, you know, that's the fact that you have this integration is a rich tradition that you have. You know, capture it now, you know.
And she is an English speaker.
Yes, yes. She's taken a number of years of Spanish classes, and I think she regrets not having followed up in college. She was took it in high school. I think she just took. Can I cut? Hello. Hi.
Okay.
Did I answer that last part?
Yeah, okay. Does she speak English? And then it follows up with why do you think this is? She's U.S. born.
Yeah, because she's U.S. born, and that's the language we speak in the household.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my wife also speaks some Spanish, but has a better comprehension too, because she's a teacher, so she does mm-hmm. those language stuff with kids.
Okay. Have you spoken with her about her language of choice? About her language choice?
My daughter?
Yes.
Yes.
You mentioned that she
take
Spanish.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I encourage her to do it more because the job opportunities increase as she can do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if she either wants to teach, if she wants to do any type of work with kids, that would be a very valuable thing to be, you know, being bilingual.
Do you have any family who live overseas? If so, where do they live?
Well, yeah, my brother who lives here in Panama City in China, that's basically, yeah.
So no one outside of Panama or outside of the U.S.?
I have a god sister who lives in Mali.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Okay. The next question may not apply, because when they come to visit Panama, your brother's already here, so
mm-hmm.
do they think other Panamanians see or treat them as less Panamanian or more U.S. American? So that quite that apply to the
yeah.
situation your brother is here. Have you ever lived abroad or lived overseas? Where and when? You mentioned you're a year in
Nigeria.
Yeah,
I lived a year in Nigeria as an exchange student at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, and that was my junior year in college, 72-73, and it was a very valuable experience. I almost stayed here permanently,
mm-hmm.
But I had to come back and finish my BA at school, otherwise I would have stayed here permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have continued, you know, graduate work there.
Mm-hmm.
Except that I fell in love and she broke my heart and I didn't want to go back after that. So I said, nah, I can't even go back to graduate school to see her anymore. But it was, I think the experience there in Nigeria they were pretty much in the British system, fine restaurant, a very rigid type system. Except for a few professors that, you know, I think had more flexibility. I remember being in an anthropology class, challenging a professor about findings in ancient Egypt and Sudan and Ethiopia, and I told my mother to send me my footlocker. You know, those days you used to carry footlockers to school, and I told her to put a couple of books in there that I would need it. And when the books came, I, you know, studied up on them and went into the professor and challenged him. And he told me not to come back to class anymore. He will give me an A, and I don't have to come back to class anymore. Okay, I got my A, and to get an A, those days were, you know, not they weren't given out. Mm-hmm. But I think he sensed that I wasn't going to relent and that I had the information. Even if I wasn't correct all the time, the fact that he had to face me as a challenge in the class, where that's not the usual relationship that they're accustomed to having with the students, you know. They dictate to you and you take the notes and then you take the exam. That's it. And as a consequence, I got very popular with a couple of students who were in the social science section and you know, invited me to some political events to kind of, you know, express a difference, you know. So that was very helpful. And, I got treated mostly because I adapted very well. Like I said, the food stuff was not a problem for me. The climate was not a problem for me. You know, having some of the, quote, amenities, you know, that you have, like a turning on a hot shower or a dishwasher or, you know, those type of things didn't bother me, not having them. So in the morning, you know, if the shower wasn't working, you caught a pail of water, and as cold as it was, you showered off. Mm-hmm. And so once I saw that type of adaptation, I was very involved. And then I got to travel with some of my classmates to areas that they lived in during the semester break and meet their families, and you know, it was a very good experience. I also played basketball, for all things, for the University of Ibadan, and we traveled for the West African Games to Togo, Dahomey, and Ghana at that time. And that was a beautiful experience because we took a bus and we were traveling all along the coast, you know. And I remember the three African Americans in the group that were traveling with us, because the girls' basketball team also went. And we stopped on the beach in Ghana when we asked the bus driver to stop, and we all walked out to the water, you know, and just stood there and cried. And we had to explain when we came back to the bus, you know, what that meant for us coming back and on that beach, you know, and the experience for us. And everybody got off the bus and said, let's do it again, you know, so that they were part with us, you know, as a team. Mm-hmm. And that was very moving. Mm-hmm. That was very moving. And I always appreciated that you know, because that was to me very symbolic of how we came together. Mm-hmm. So that was very important. The living abroad, like I said, other than being considered more an American, unquote, than a African Panamanian was more significant. I think once in I'm trying to remember, I think it was in Togo, either Togo or Dahomey, I spoke Spanish, and because there were some tourists from Spain who were coming through, you know, in the market, and I spoke some Spanish, and people were like, wow, you speak Spanish too, you know? Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. I have to explain the Panama connection, but other than that, it was more like an African-American connection.
What was your experience there in terms of what people seem to know or think about Panamanians overall, or of Panamanians, African Panamanians, as you described yourself, in particular, of what's in the center?
Well, most of them did not have a knowledge of the type of demographic that we had in Panama. Mm-hmm. They knew of the Panama Canal. Mm-hmm. and just thought of it as a Spanish-speaking country. That's essentially it. For them to understand the connection between coming from Africa to the Caribbean to Panama, or from Africa to Panama, and having Africans in those geographic entities was revealing to them. And that was in both Ghana, more so in Ghana and in Nigeria, those two countries were much more, the students and some older people were so appreciative of it, you know, because the level at which they understood the American television mm-hmm. was a difference in terms of entertainment versus the real person having mm-hmm. a connection. Mm-hmm. And now knowing that there's something even more beyond the United States that connected them was very important. And you could talk about the similarities in food and dress and climate, mm-hmm. you know, in worship and so forth. So that was very important.
What specific message do you want to communicate to the younger people of the community, meaning any generation behind you?
I would say that the principal message is to have a value system. Have a value system that's African-based in the context of it values the connection between people more than material wealth. It values the connection of families more than your social class status. It values your level of responsibility not only to yourself, to your family, but to your community, that makes a connection between what you do, what the other person does, and what that means for all of you. So if I drive a taxi and I make X number of dollars, does not make me any less of value than if I'm a deputy in the Assemblea, or if I'm a colonel in the military, in the police, the Guardia Nacional, or that I'm a professor in the University of Panama. Those connections have to be made in the context of moving all of us forward. But the sense of that responsibility has to be organized, because the level at which the society is organized right now would not make much of an impact being unorganized. It would just be an individual act of either frustration or an individual act of something brilliant that you did. And everybody cannot be brilliant in the sense of a genius, mm-hmm. but everybody can contribute. And if you can contribute, whether you become a big star or whether you can contribute as a housewife or as a taxi driver or as a cleaner, it's a contribution. And that collective sense is hard for young people to understand, because I think there's more value placed in material wealth, in material gain that you have, the more immediate. And the more immediate your material gain, the better, you know. So if you can organize them to begin to understand that change, that value change is necessary to transform not only you, but your family and your community, is difficult but necessary, because I think the erosion of those values is so strong, mm-hmm. And the disconnectedness is so strong, you know, even between the families. I mean, even within families, where you see that, where, you know, a mother who struggles is eventually, or father is eventually left to either support that son or daughter who is gotten into trouble or doesn't have the ability to support their families anymore. So while there are visible signs of how those things work in that connectedness, the young people often don't see it. They just take it for granted, or they dismiss it. And that's to me the hardest thing to fight back at this point in this society. The other part is to look at the world, you know, to look at the world beyond your barrio, to look at the world in terms of where we are as a people, to look at the world in terms of where Panama is as a country, and to begin to see those connectedness. But that's not going to happen overnight, and that's not going to happen in an unorganized way. And my greatest fear is that it will be too late, or it will be too long before those types of things can happen, because the disparity in the society is becoming so apparent between the haves and the have-not, but also the effect that those have-nots are having on family structure. Mm-hmm. You know, where the only way of escaping it is to do the immediate stuff that gives you gratification, and whatever that takes, you do it. You know, as opposed to looking at it in a more structural way of changing things in the society. I often wonder if the level at which this society operates is in context of people really trying to do good for the society, meaning the elected official responsible, or whether it's just the appearance of doing good for society while there's personal aggrandizement. And that's the disturbing, because people see that happening over and over and over. You know, and somebody comes up with a different way of saying it or appearance, and they take on to that, and then later on find the same practice, because that is a different value system that they have. And people get frustrated, and what do? The easiest way to lash out is the person next to you, the person as powerless as you. So you can shoot each other, you can mistreat each other, and business go on as usual. You know? And young people don't often see that connection. They don't see the immediate thing. You know, if I shoot so-and-so, I feel better and people know my reputation. But the general structure doesn't change. All changes is that now people know you as a person who has a gun and can kill them.
Are you involved with any community groups or organizations? If so, what roles do you play in them?
Glad you asked that one, because they wouldn't forgive me in New York if I didn't get that in there. I'm presently involved with two organizations in New York. One is more on the cultural side, Conjunto Nuevo Milenio, which is a Panamanian folklore group that we do in New York, in Brooklyn, New York. The thing that I like about the Conjunto, I just joined, this is my third year, so I'm new to the whole folkloric, Panamanian folkloric genre, is that I think we're an open group in the sense of we value all the traditions in Panama. So it's not just the pollera and the montuno and the típico. You know, we talk about the Congo music, we talk about the other type of music that influences part of the folklore of Panama. And while it hasn't been easy to get that represented all the time because of the resources, we are committed to doing that. So that's one thing that I like about the Conjunto. And we also learn, you know, because part of it is learning as you become more expressive of the tradition. The other group that I'm with is MODIPA, Movimiento Popular Democrático de Panamá. And MODIPA is not a political party, it is a movement. It is a movement based upon a principle of the distribution of power and wealth in a society that is fair and is just. One of the principal things that attracted me to MODIPA is that it wasn't pigeonholing you into saying, well, I belong to this party and therefore whoever is nominated, I support that. We don't have a candidate because, again, we're not a political party. The first tack that we did was to try to get the voto en el exterior, the vote in the exterior for Panamanians who can register and be able to vote in the 2009 election. That was the main effort that Modipa started with, and it kind of grew from a general meeting that we had with Panamanian community talking about that and saw the need to do an organized effort for that. So that's what we've been trying to work on, and part of that is that because of the new law that permits Panamanians who live in the exterior to be able to vote in the presidential election in 2009 with some prerequisites, was to get those prerequisites in place. So for instance, if I'm a naturalized American now, so I could not vote in the Panamanian election by law because I have acquired a citizenship of another country. I don't lose my nationality, I just cannot do my voting in the presidential election. My daughter, however, being the sibling of a Panamanian by nationality, is eligible to vote in the 2009 presidential election if she gets certain prerequisites in place. You know, she has to go get a cedula and register with to be able to get the proper documentation to vote in the 2009, but I could not. So part of that discussion led to a second phase, which is to move to get double citizenship. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of Panamanians are practicing double citizenship now, but legally you cannot vote if you have acquired a citizenship. And the law says this, it's not my interpretation. If you have acquired citizenship of another country, you cannot vote. You don't use your citizenship. In fact, the Constitution suspends your citizenship, and then the Assemblea, or I think the Supreme Court, has to. There is a process in which this has to happen, and the Assemblea or the Supreme Court has to do a certain process to enact double citizenship that will give us full rights under the Constitution. So that's what we've done. We've gathered petitions, we've submitted it to the Assemblea, and I think they have to meet like two or three consecutive sessions for it to be considered. Mm-hmm. And I think they're going into the second consecutive session, and we want to make sure it's on the agenda so that we can get that enacted. And that will be a major impact not only on the election, but on the country. We thought that we could have made a major impact, because potentially it could be anywhere from 25,000 to 40,000 votes outside of Panama. Mm-hmm. If people could vote, and imagine the impact on a presidential election. Mm-hmm. That could turn a presidential election. Unfortunately, that did not occur to the extent that we wanted in the numbers to make a movement possible. Mm-hmm. So we are now moving on the front of doing the double citizenship, and that will also have another significant impact. And the potential of that increases, the potential voting block of that increases to maybe 80,000, 90,000 people. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the exterior, again, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. So Modipa is trying to move on that front right now. And those are the two main organizations that I'm working with currently, in terms of, you know, Panamanian-related issues.
Okay. You can list any other community activities that you're involved in. What are your specific roles with those two first? I know you are a drummer with the folklore group, right?
Yes, I'm a drummer with the Conjunto Nuevo Milenio. Mm-hmm. I'm now learning to dance, since I want to be dual purpose, you know, in case some dancers don't show up and we don't have enough male dancers. So they're working my knees and my body out. By my own training and experience, I'm a West African djembe orchestra musician, meaning that in the djembe tradition of West Africa orchestra, I play the bottom drums, which are the drums you play with a stick and a rod for the bell. So you have the bell with your left hand, or if you're right-handed, and you hit the stick with the drum, as opposed to just playing the djembe drum with both hands. I got into it late because my daughter was in African dance, and I used to take her to classes, and know, you see the rehearsal and then you see the final product. And I said, oh man, I saw how they started off and I saw how they ended up. You know, I can. So I've been doing this since 97.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a really awakening experience too, because the path in which you learn the music is also a path to open you up to other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you listen better, you're more disciplined about what you do, and you're more appreciative of other music and other traditions as you learn about this tradition. And the tradition in which the djembe tradition that in which I got into was more as a warrior art, meaning that you had to prepare yourself both physically as well as mentally. So you're learning the mental piece, but you can't bring those negative stuff to the art, and your body has to be physically fit to keep that tradition. That's one of the things that has helped me when I had the diabetes. You know, that I was in decent shape and was able to, you know, weather that too. So that tradition has been very valuable. In fact, it took me to Ghana in 2003 for the Panafest Festival. The group that I played with, Harambe Dance Company, was the only African-American dance troupe that came to Panafest that year. And we traveled throughout Ghana for 10 days, and it was an amazing experience to have the Ghanaians welcome us home and connect with us. You know, so that's been very valuable. And it's also helped me travel in other parts of the United States with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, interesting enough, got me into the conjunto because the husband and wife couple that was performing the conjunto, I played with like 5 years, 6 years ago, in Harambe Dance Company. And when the conjunto, Millennium, was looking for a drummer, he said, well, I know a Panamanian guy who drums, you know, but he's in the West African tradition, but, you know, maybe you'll be interested. He called me, and the rest is how I got into the conjunto. I also teach at LaGuardia Community College in the social science section about community change, and I do academic advising to Hunter School of Social Work. I'm a social worker by academic training, not necessarily by vocation. And I work with other groups in the community on an ad hoc basis in terms of making sure that they're about positive change in our community, without, you know, being partisan about one group over the other. I've always worked with students also, you know, whenever, from the time my daughter entered, she went to a private school in kindergarten, working with students of color to give them support as part of a larger connection community. And it's so interesting because the older students then adopted my daughter, you know, in terms of showing her the ropes through the school. But now I have so many of those students who are now anywhere from 20, 25 to 30 years old that, you know, call me and say how they're doing. They have children now, you know. So it's very, very nice to connect that way, and people remember you in a positive way, you know, what you contributed towards them. So that's been very blessed.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very blessed that way. And that's part of the connection that I want my daughter to experience, but also to see me do, but also to know that that's the way our tradition should be,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that she can play a role in these things.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other information that you want to include that we haven't touched upon?
Just a few points. One is, you know, I talked about the West Indian piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that's an important piece is that we begin to define ourselves in the world. It's important that we determine who we are and what we want to be called. My sense of the West Indian thing is that it's so ingrained in some of us that to challenge it is viewed as heresy, in a sense, you know, that you don't, that you're speaking evil of something. I'm not. I'm just giving you a different perspective on what that history is. And to look at it from that historical point is at least important for me to express so that other people can take the information and then they're responsible for dealing with it. You know, I can't inject you with it, but I can offer it to you, and then you have a responsibility of doing something with that information. The level at which I think our being is being challenged throughout the world is that our existence is, as African people throughout the world, is always challenged because we are not in the same position of power in all parts of the world. So wherever we can document our stories, wherever we can reinterpret our history, wherever we can connect with different entities of our community, whether it's the young people, the children, the older people, it's an important contribution towards saying to the world, this is who we are. And that's one of the things that really fascinated me about this project, because I was telling, I think it was Nyasha. And by the way, Nyasha, I call her Nyasha because I have a goddaughter whose name is Nyasha, spelled the same way. And so when I said, yeah, but I call her Nyasha, she said, yeah, that's the proper pronunciation, but I think she pronounces it different. But one of the ways that I was telling Nyasha, I think it was Nyasha, maybe it was Dr.
Wanko.
Yeah, maybe it was that when I was in college, I had a person I consider a mentor, Dr. Blackman, Donald Blackman from Barbados, tell me, you know, stories about his family who left for Panama, mm-hmm. and he never got connected to them. Why don't I do my dissertation, go to graduate school and write about your people? Your people, this was 1971. You know, your people need to have their own history written for them. And so when I came back to New York that summer, I interviewed a neighbor of us that lived in Panama, working to the part of our extended family, Mr. Clark. And, you know, I had this big reel-to-reel tape, which was innovative at that time, but it was a portable one. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big standard one. And I interviewed him about leaving Barbados and coming to Panama. And this guy, this doctor, we call him Papa Clark, described in such detail his journey, the day of the week, the date, the boat that he was on, the condition of the skies, where he landed in Panama, where he walked to. I mean, it was just absolute detail. And I had it on wheel to wheel, and I took it to Nigeria with me, 72. I don't know why, but I took it. And a professor there, an African-American professor there, who was like a deputy in the library, said, you know, this is like rich history because it makes a connection beyond the Africa to Caribbean. You know, you have another migration connection. Mm-hmm. He said, can I hold the tape to copy it, you know, so we can get it into our archives at the University of Badon. And I didn't have that much value on it, you know, because it was kind of still a living history for me. Mm-hmm. I said, sure, you know. And sure enough, he mailed it back to me. So I was telling her, I have to find the tape. And I don't know what condition it's in, but I think it will be a good way of archiving something, you know, to preserve a real story of somebody who made that transit. And again, that's an important voice to connect. But I'm just glad that this project is happening, and I want to support it in any way I can, because it's an important expression and acknowledgement of our existence in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. And we need to have these type of projects supported so that people build on this success. You know, and there's much more, and there's a shorter time period for us to capture these things. So I'm glad to be to run into it. You know, I've learned as I've gotten older in the world that sometimes you just have to go with the flow. And like I said, I could have come last year, right? I could have waited and come next year, but I'm here this year and made this connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider that a blessing. You know, that's how you try to. That's how I try to live my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are the things that I want to impart to you. You know, keep the good work. Keep focus on that work, and you know it's not always the material thing, but you can say to your children, "I made this type of contribution to our voice in the world."
Mm-hmm.
And that is more lasting than if you accumulate all the wealth and people forgot about you after the wealth is over.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for participating, and feel free to contact us if you have any questions.
Oh, I will.
Or if you have anything, or if you want to contribute in any other way, if you have any song lyrics you want to share, feel free to contact us. Thank you again for your time.
Oh, one of the things that I mentioned to... Dr. Wanko. I mentioned to her, I sent her an email to say that one of the other consideration I think should be made for interview was Panamanians who were in transit, meaning that they have homes in Panama and in the U.S. And there are a lot of them who are doing that, you know, and that's going to increase by next year when you have a presidential election, because people are coming back to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be nice to make those type of connections, because I think that's a very steady population.
Mm-hmm.
I know the population of people repatriating here is increasing, but I think that transit population is very valuable to, you know, because they have their feet in both worlds. You know, they have their feet in both worlds, and that's a very valuable thing. And it will be interesting to see how they transmit that to their relatives, both here and in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I want to share that with you. Can I ask you to take a video of the back of my shirt?
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know.
I might have to do
stop. You want to stop and then refocus, or you want?
Oh yeah, we can edit it.
Okay. This is a shirt I've had for 8 by 8 years now.
You kind of pulled up wrong.
Is that better? Tell me.
Yes. Here we go. My ancestors built it. You will see where the Frenchmen started. You will see where they left off to. You will see how the Americas parted to let the big ships through. Take a trip through the Panama Canal, the 8th wonder of the world. The land divided, the world united through the Panama Canal. Well, that's cool.
And this was done by an African Panamanian in Brooklyn. Shirt is about 8 years old. So about 6 years old.
Seriously?
Yeah. So now, festival we have in Brooklyn, you know, they do more of this now.
That's good. Well, thank you.
Thank you
so much. It's been a pleasure.